How's the sound? Ah, good. Thank you. Well, good afternoon. Thanks for coming to this the final lecture. I'm going to talk in this lecture from 1984 to the present, the last 20 years, and I'm going to, again, not try to be comprehensive, but try to focus, because you're the kind of audience who knows a lot of these issues. I'll try and focus on things you might not know and that are trends that are significant. There is, of course, the elephant in the room for those of us in Cape Town and the rest of South Africa, which is the fratricidal conflict on the Cape Times at the moment, which you're all reading about, and we will come back to it later. I have been on the phone to people about it this morning. I don't have any words of comfort, especially, but we'll come back to it later, because otherwise, if we started with it now, we'd never touch on anything else. Imagine if there was a South African who went to America, wrote a thesis on the South African media, came back, implemented it, made sure everyone called him by his first name, from the cleaners upwards, was extremely successful, made mistakes, went to Europe, was not successful there, came back, did more clever things, and finally was put in charge of the whole media company. And the first thing he says is, I don't want a salary at all, pay me nothing. So if he doesn't accept share options, so he only pays the rent if he improves the company in the long term. He learns the lessons, don't be greedy, build market share, be patient for the long term. Someone like that actually existed, and this is what he looks like, Koos Bekker. And this is another picture of him. He's now the biggest, it's the biggest third world, developing country media company in the world. Its value, I'm now going to switch to something else. There was another picture here. Missing something. There's something missing. What I wanted to show you is what has happened to the South African media in the last 20 years. His company is now worth half a trillion rand. The chart is missing. Oh, there it is. Okay. There we are. Okay, this rather technologically sophisticated chart. It's really just to show you that the English press now has two companies, one worth, or in fact, Times Media is worth about $2.5 billion on the stock market today. The Independent has just been sold for $2 billion, which is actually an inflated view of its value, I think, because some of the money was provided by the seller, the Irish. And so it's probably worth that a little less. But let's not quibble about a billion here or there. Naspers is now worth 480 billion, nearly half a trillion rand. It's, I think, the biggest company on the Joburg Stock Exchange, way outclipsed Anglo American and all those companies and many more recent ones. Well, how did he do it? He took the long view. He studied at I think Columbia or Cornell in the States. He did a thesis on setting up a television channel. Came back and started Mnet. Obviously, the government cooperated with him, but the shares were distributed between the two Afrikaans and two English newspaper groups. The English newspaper group sold their shares as soon as they could. I remember talking to the old Argus CEO, that was Doug Band, and he said, well, Mnet never makes us any money. He wanted a profit and sold it. And then, of course, Cyril Ramaphosa and others took over the other company, where various iterations from SAN to Times Media to Avuso back to Times Media. They also sold their shares in Mnet, which would have included DSTV. And they're now worth a grand total of $2.5 billion. Naspers under Koos Becker just grew and grew. And it's now much more than a media company. It's predominantly involved in China, also Russia, a lot of Eastern Europe and a lot of other places. He also does own media, and most of his money is in the internet and commercial operations. But he does own media companies even in China and places like that. Obviously, the experience of working in an authoritarian society and running newspapers was a value. But what I also want to show is, if you look to the right, broadcasting, the monopoly has been completely broken, and I'm going to tell you how it was done. So SABC isn't nearly as important as it was. ETV has been established. There are all these radio stations. There are about 250 radio stations in all 11 languages and many besides. And they all have to, my little contribution was, they all have to provide their own news. So the monopoly has been broken, and that's besides the question of the internet.
Where does the Mail and Guardian fit
in? I didn't mention it because it's small, and you know there are a lot of other things. But the Mail and Guardian was started as the Weekly Mail by Anton Harbour and Erwin Manoyan after the closing of the Rand Daily Mail. So it really was an outcrop of the closure of the Rand Daily Mail. And it was eventually sold to the British Guardian, which then sold it to, Trevor Noah, but it's Trevor Ngube, who is a Zimbabwean publisher who did have some funding from George Soros and others, and he's still running it. But, you know, of course, you could think of many others that I haven't mentioned. So the way we broke the monopoly, I'm going to have to go through here, was on the Independent Broadcasting Authority. This is the best picture I could find of it, and it's not the one I wanted. But when we, in 1994, what had happened is in the early 90s, many of us started thinking of how to create a fair media afterwards and break the monopoly of the SABC and so on, so that never again could one company, person, or institution dictate what everybody in the country thought. And we held a conference called Free, Fair and Open, which included all the political parties, nationalist, communist, ANC, etc., and all the broadcasters. And we took three decisions there. The first was that we will establish an independent broadcasting authority to grant license on an equitable basis. Secondly, that the SABC board must be fired and replaced. And thirdly, that the CEO must be fired and replaced. And what was achieved in the IBA when it was started was You know, coming from a background of campaigning against censorship, press censorship and so on, I was reluctant to accept the idea that media needed regulating, but I'm totally persuaded for a number of reasons. Firstly, if you go back to the start of radio in North America, US and Canada, where there was an argument that there should be no regulation at all, what happened was that one guy would start a radio station in one town and someone in the next town would have a more powerful transmitter, and he'd deliberately use the same frequency to wipe out the first guy, just blast the airwaves. And often this was used in Canada too, between rival religious stations, clergymen fighting the neighboring clergymen with more power. So even in the States, they realized you needed to regulate frequencies. But beyond that, South Africa, and I agreed with this, rejected the American model, which is more or less, you know, anybody can get it, you know, which obviously favors the better off, which is obviously a problem in South Africa because all the people with money in 1994 would have been white. No longer entirely so true. So we set four core objectives, and I think the secret of regulation is to have a minimal regulation, target it, enforce it, and then get out of the way, which is the problem that you find. In the early days, we achieved a lot because people didn't really understand the power it had. But nowadays, the regulator is much, much slower to achieve anything, and quite often even tries to move backwards. But the four objectives were: we wanted diverse ownership, diverse content, a disadvantaged ownership, and diverse ownership. So diverse ownership, diverse content, local content, and disadvantaged ownership. So. And that really produced what you saw in that chart. We licensed nearly 100 community radio stations right in the beginning. And the only additional things we required of the stations was, one, they must provide news of their own, a total of 30 minutes a day, I think it was, on a regular basis. So you could do one 30-minute program or 31-minute programs, but you would be providing news. And of course, there are a lot of different languages. And the other was, if you are a music station, by a definition that was established in the law, you must provide 20% of your music in must be South African. And that we thought that would exclude classical music stations, but in fact, we thought we would need to make an exception, and we would have, but it wasn't necessary. Fine Music Radio, classical FM, fulfill the requirements, because if something is made by a South African orchestra or South African players, there are various ways to satisfy the requirement. And it's been extremely good for the music sector. And if you look at the charts, South African music has continuously improved since that happened in about 1995. And things like Freshly Ground and all these others probably would not have happened, certainly not nearly as much Die Antwoord and these which have gone on to international success. When we started, even the SABC's commercial station 5FM had less than 0.5% of its music was South African. It was all American. And we had big fights. A lot of people said you could never do it. Unfortunately, South Africa does have music. If we'd made a soccer requirement, it might have been more difficult. But we do have great music in South Africa, and we did research, and we found that 20% was a reasonable figure. And 5FM had to go from 0.5% to 20%, which was perfectly acceptable. There were people like the poet Mzwaki, who demanded 100% South African music, which of course it would have killed off radio stations. And the broadcasters were saying it's got to be, you know, it's got to be the democracy of the finger. You must be able to get whatever you want, and if you want 100% American music, that's fine. And we said no to that too. And by the way, in a place like Congo, which does have great music but didn't have these regulations, their stations were all playing American music and giving no outlet to their own wonderful content. So that worked very well. And the other thing it does mean is there is In Soweto, there are three or four stations. In Alex, in big townships like Bochabello and Winterfeld, there are radio stations using the local languages, having some of their own news. I don't want to say it's fantastic or perfect and it's all particularly professional, but it gets better all the time. And they do. It does mean that in a very good part of proportion of South Africa, you can get news in your own language, other than on SABC. So you do have a way of testing the one against the other. So that, I think, has been a big success. And the last thing we did in my term was to license ETV. And since then, of course, what happened with the regulator is they decided to combine it with the telecom regulator. So it's now something called ICASA. And ICASA has become, first of all, when you combine telecommunications with broadcasting, the financial proportions are such that so much money goes to telecoms and a tiny, tiny proportion goes to broadcasting. So in many countries, the result is broadcasting gets ignored, and that is indeed what happened in South Africa. Just a note on the information economy, because they all converge. Broadcasting and telecoms converge. The reason why our internet has remained so slow and expensive has been because of a term I heard in Soweto called javelin throwing. Javelin throwing is when you're in the government, you throw the javelin, and when you leave the government, you go and catch it. And what that means in simple language is that people in government set the rules in such a way that we entirely missed the dot-com boom. And this is really a phenomenally bad thing for South Africa economically in every other way. So our internet is slower and more expensive than Morocco's and many other African countries. But that happened because the people inside government gave Telkom a monopoly. Many of them became shareholders in Telkom afterwards. By the time they licensed the one competitor, Neotel, it was so hamstrung with requirements and regulations that it's never really got off the ground. It might still do so, but it won't. While we're just to finish on the information economy, although it is slightly off point, but it so happens that the new minister has got through some decisions which will improve our internet broadband over the next few months. I'm pleased to say I happen to have been in discussion, so I'm aware of it. And that's going to be a rather good thing. But the key missing factor still is the regulator. The regulator is almost non-functional at this point. And it was set up, you know, South Africa's constitution is the only one in the world that guarantees the independence of the broadcast regulator, which we thought was a very fine idea, and was a fine idea, and did more or less work in my time, although it was fraying at the edges very badly by the time I left. But now it's so dysfunctional that the people who are trying to fix it think the only likely way forward is going to be, and I don't know when it'll happen, there's no urgency visible among the within the government, but the only way it'll happen will be to go to the British model, which is get rid of all the people who were appointed, the councillors or commissioners, like we were, who were appointed in public and presumed to represent certain sort of public interests, and put in professional full-time regulators. In Britain, Ofcom is the equivalent. It has a director general, I think, and then two deputies. And that might be the only way to do it. So it's rather sad that this experiment has not worked. And one would like to see a system where the law is adhered to in such a way that you do get people appointed for their expertise. The idea was you have a lawyer, you have a broadcaster, you have someone from commerce, from the advertising industry, and so on, so that you have a wide representative group of people from the community. But it has become so politicized. And in fact, the other reason why things don't work, and this includes the SABC, is because of the revolving door between the Department of Communications, the SABC board, the CASA board and one or two other bodies. So once you've been through that revolving door, you're no longer independent, because when you leave, all the people on that council are no longer there. But if you want to come, the ones that replaced us, if they didn't get on, they would have a safe perch back in the Department of Communication. So independence was lost. So that's the bad news about broadcasting. But fortunately, we got broadcasting off the ground before people were too aware of what was being done, and the job was relatively well achieved, and the monopoly is broken. So we're going to discuss the Cape Times and these other problems, and the SABC, which is continuously, I'm not going to say too much about it, so obviously continuously faulty. But the truth is, the fights they have about them are a lot less important than they used to be. The monopoly has been broken. I want to go on to talk a little bit about the print press. These are the two Irishmen who have been controlling the Cape Times, all the Cape Town papers for some years. The one on the left is Anthony O'Reilly. He managed to get the paper because he actually had a good record. He was representing Heinz, a very, very enormous American company, as you realize. He was the head of it. When he got Heinz to invest into Mugabe's Zimbabwe, and he was the only American company substantial investor for a long time, and so, you know, he had a good record in Southern Africa. There was a big dispute about whether he should get it within the ANC. People like Mletsi Mbeki and Palo Jordan and others were very much against it. But what he did is, he'd already had Mandela stay with him in Bermuda, was it, a couple of times. And so when he was negotiating with Anglo said, we'll only do this if the ANC agreed. He picked up the phone, called Mandela, went round there and came back and said, Mandela says it's fine. And that was really the only criterion. He then got into what you might call some Irish on Irish violence. The two of them, these two gentlemen, have had a long-standing feud in Ireland, which was eventually won by Dennis O'Brien on the right, who's now in charge of the company, and was in his control when they sold it to Iqbal Survey recently. Now, in case you think that we're unique in having bad proprietors, O'Brien has sued his own journalists, he's forced people out for writing about him, and so on. So he's not exactly a great character. O'Reilly handled things in a much more smooth and shrewd way. He brought in with him really important international media figures, Ben Bradley of the Washington Post, and Anthony Sampson, great British journalist, ex-Observer, among other things, Drum, and so on. Put them on a board, flew them out here once a year, parked the private jets at the airport, came in and saw the president, and stayed for the week of the first week of Parliament every year, and so on. But actually, they had no impact at all on what was going on, and people inside the company. For me, the biggest harm they did was to undermine the stature of editors. Within the company statute, editors may not have had the statute one would have liked them to have had before. But under O'Reilly, editors became sort of, they were poorly paid, they were unhappy in their jobs, they found themselves with very little power. This was run very much as a money-making effort, and not to be too controversial. And the consequence was that O'Reilly brought in about 350 million rand to buy control of the company, and something like that later to buy the rest. He took out over 4 billion. That's the minimum figure we have. It's probably quite a bit more. So it was, you know, what's the classic definition of colonialism? You raid the colony to benefit the metropole. And so this was a classic case of colonialism. And to that degree, if that degree only, Iqbal Survey is right in saying the company was really milked dry. He never put money into presses. When he bought the company, it had big printing presses. He ran them into the ground and never replaced them, and then just switched the contract to an outsider. Did the same with buildings. You know, in St. George's Street, the old building that's been in the newspaper hands for over a century was sold off. Cut staff. So what Survey has inherited is a shadow of its former self, and that is due to the Irish carpetbaggers. Sadly, I'm not convinced. Everything one reads about Survey indicates he hasn't fully grasped how bad this all is. Although he will be rescued by the government. I want to say a little bit. I'm going to try and leave some time more for discussion because this is the last session. But let me just keep going on to a few other things I'd like to bring up. We then had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings on the media, and I found them. I attended almost all of them, and I've read the transcripts a few times, and I found them rather absurd. And it was not because I was against the TRC. I supported it, and knowing it wasn't perfect and it wasn't legally all that pristine. But what happened was one of O'Reilly's Irishmen represented the Argus group. So he arrived to explain what the Star and the Argus and the Cape Times had done about apartheid. Well, of course, he wasn't in a position to say anything meaningful. Now, there were others, some perhaps in this room, who also appeared, but it was an unsatisfactory process. It wasn't anyone saying, this is what we did, this is what we didn't do, and I was there when it happened. For the Rand Daily Mail, which had closed by then, they sent the chairman, one Cyril Ramaphosa, who was very charming, because he'd now taken over that company. He was very charming, as he always is, and defended the company. But again, you know, I would have liked to have seen people from the Rand Daily Mail really talk about the Rand Daily Mail rather than some outsider. When it came to the SABC, they didn't have the chairman, Christopher Leun of that time, or the CEO of that time, Wynand Harmse. Some more junior people did show up. Let me see if I've got him. Yeah, Johan Pretorius on the left at the top there, who said I was known as the Tainhase Mace, which he was, basically the servant of the presidency when he was head of when he was the SABC's correspondent on the presidency. He came and he defended his position. I go into it a little bit more in the book. We don't have time now, but he and one other spoke about how things had been at the SABC, but they were relatively not senior enough, and they weren't questioned clearly enough, and so it was a fairly unsatisfactory event. And in fact, it was left to one man who I do regard as an Afrikaner hero, Sam Pieter Blanche, who'd been in the Broederbund, been on the SABC board, and he appeared and he said, this is what we did, and this is why we did it, and this is why it was wrong. And he also explained how some of the defences of Pretorius and others, who'd said, oh, we fought on this issue, and some people were able to show that in each case what they were really fighting was actually internal Nationalist Party battles. You know, they would say, we don't want this guy on the air, we do want this guy on the air. And it sounded like it was a press freedom battle, but really it was an internal battle. So that was the TRC. And just out of interest, NASPERS, in their board meeting, I think it was the vice chairman of NASPERS, said, we're not going to go to the TRC. Why? They sent their annual report. And that was it. And we're not going to go to the TRC because the vice chairman said, I think I have the quote correctly, he said, why should we help them or help the enemy? So that was rather unfortunate. Now, I want to say a little bit about the independent group because that's obviously going to come up, and the Guptas. We can show you. This is the new head of the Independent, and this is the head of the New Age. The New Age, I'm told, I haven't been able to verify, is taking an income of over 120 million a year. And so it's probably breaking even or even making a small profit. And that's because it's getting, if you switch on your SABC, you'll see that there are new age events which are, involve government ministers speaking, telecom providing sponsorship and funds, other government companies also providing assistance, advertising, etc., various types. SABC is in the partnership. SABC gives them a lot of advertising. I'm not sure that that helps them that much, but one way or another, they're getting enough advertising and other support to not lose too much money, which is a fair price to pay for the inside track they have when important commercial decisions are made in government. Now, Survey and Gupta are not on the same team. They have some rivalries, but Survey will do the same thing. And so I don't think the company will fold. It will be able to retain some of its some advertising and gain some advertising, government advertising. But as you've seen, if you read the Cape Times this last couple of weeks, I've been trying to think of a word for newspaper suicide, but that's what it looks like. It's this fratricidal conflict every day where one editor attacks another. It must be hell to work in there. I know people are looking to resign. Apparently quite a lot of subscriptions have been cancelled, and they won't be replaced because the people who subscribe are people like us in this room, older people who are used to newspapers being at the bottom of your driveway every day. Younger people don't buy newspapers. They certainly don't subscribe. They have access to the internet, obviously. On the plus side of that, you know, if you even on SABC, if you listen, I mean, I'm very struck by, you know, I used this quote earlier this week from Gwendolyn Carter, who said that the sort of basic flavor of conversation in South Africa had become so insulated already by the late 50s and would get more and more so. First because of the government actions, and of course later perhaps also because of sanctions and so on and other isolation. But I think that's really been broken. If you listen to the radio in the mornings and you listen to black presenters and analysts as well as white, they're in touch with what's happening in China. They understand how the Chinese economy impacts on us. They understand the role of Ben Bernanke at the Fed in Washington and his replacement, Janet Yellen, and so on. These things, in my recollection, were not so 20, 30 years ago. So the monopoly is broken in that sense, obviously, with the internet and the access to the outside world that we have now. We are a very different country as a nation dealing in ideas. We're a very different country. The last thing I want to talk about before we stop and maybe have a bit of a discussion is the secrecy bill. I talked to South Africa's secret weapon this morning. That's obviously Raymond Lowe, who is now 88 years old and still travels the world working on press freedom issues. And so I have the latest information about it. As you probably know, it was passed by both houses of parliament and sent to the president. The president is sitting on it. He hasn't signed it into law, so it's still in abeyance. The features of it have been changed a number of times, but the obvious worst aspects of it are that it creates a duty on the journalist to report if he or she ever gets classified documents. Secondly, the journalist has a duty to tell the authorities who his source was, where the newspaper got the documents from. And thirdly, that is a jailable, failure to do so is a jailable offence for the journalist. This is obviously potentially very serious. Why is he holding it up? Almost certainly because there's been a lot of pressure on him to take it to either drop it or take it to the Constitutional Court. He doesn't particularly want to do either. However, he knows there are armies of lawyers waiting to take it to the Constitutional Court. So if it's passed, and signed into law. There'll be a constitutional court case immediately. So what's he doing? He seems to be stalling. We'll see what happens. Of course, it is somewhat ironic that in my day, when in 1979, when I was president of the Journalists Union, and the I had a meeting with P.W. Buerta because the Advocate General Bill had come up. Now, technically, it deals with very different things, but its underlying purpose was exactly the same. The Advocate General Bill was put up by P.W. Buerta after Muldergate, and now that he was safely Prime Minister, he wanted to stop such investigations by journalists and publishing of scandal in government. And that was the way to do it. And the way it was done was, again, the sort of backhanded way you do it. The Advocate General would be a new post to investigate corruption. And once the Advocate General was seized of an issue, the press would not be allowed to write about it. That was the backhanded way. And of course, this is the same, has the same object, to stop us writing about scandal by saying that it's classified, and you have an obligation to tell us if you get any document that's classified, so you won't be able to write about the corruption either. So I think the intention is identical, although the mechanism is very different. So where does that leave us? You know, Churchill always said on occasion that the United States will always do the right thing, but only after exploring every other option. With the ANC, pre-Zuma, I would have said the ANC always does the right thing, but only after, that's maybe an exaggeration, but it would often do the right thing, but only after any possible credit for it is evaporated, because they've done so, explored so many wrong options. With Zuma now, I don't know. I am definitely more concerned about the ownership issues in the media than I am even about the secrecy bill. Secrecy bill is bad, and we don't know how it will work out. But when you have vigorous journalists, as we saw in the past, I think South Africa's journalists stand up pretty well historically overall. They were right on the arms deal, they were right on Muldergate. You know, those issues, and even the TRC, although the TRC went into a lot more detail, and papers like the Weekly Mail and the Freyweer plot had gone further than the mainstream press, much of the source material of the TRC came from newspapers. And if you'd read your Rand Daily Mail with your bacon and eggs every morning, you knew that apartheid was pretty bad and did pretty bad things. The only slightly light note I can close on is to tell the story about Mandela and Ray Lowe. This is Ray Lowe, who was whom I spoke about yesterday. He was blocked from joining the Rand Daily Mail because he had committed the great sin of having an Afrikaans name. So in the 40s, he couldn't get a job because his name was Lowe. Anyway, eventually overcame that obstacle somehow and rose. And by 39, he was editor of the Rand Daily Mail. His editorship coincided with Forster's as Prime Minister. It was rather interesting because in the era of Verwoerd, when you had a philosopher king, the editor of the Rand Daily Mail was Gander, who was a great thinker and took him on head on. By the time of Forster, when it was more about the jackboot, Ray was tough. He was kind but tough, and is tough, and he took him on and fought the fight and grew circulation throughout that period. He's now 88 and he continues to fight for press freedom all over the world. And the one story I want to tell you about him and Mandela, he would go to Mandela when he was president and say, you know, I've just come from a jail in Cameroon and there's a journalist there and I'd like you to intervene on my behalf. And Mandela would say, I understand. This afternoon I will call the president and I will say that I've had you in here and your colleagues, and I was able to assure you that I would phone the president, and I was sure you would assure me that no harm would come to this journalist, and that he would be released soon. So that's how Mandela did. He'd call the president and say, you know, I've just heard about this concern. I assured the journalists in South Africa that no harm will come to him and he'll be released soon. I'm sure that's true, isn't it? And of course, coming from Mandela, that's what they would do. So that's, just to close, that's a classic Mandela story, but it's also a classic Ray Lowe story. And as I say, he's 88 years old and still going into jails all over Africa and elsewhere and fighting for the press. I thought I'd stop here. There's plenty more time, and I can tell you some other things, but I thought you may want to ask some questions.
Yes. The Cape Times. I thought you were going to talk about the Cape Times.
Well, the Cape Times is this man's paper. He's the guy. Sure. Let's go into that a little bit more. He's now in control. On Friday, before he went off to Davos, as one does, he had a Twitter discussion in which he said he's already put 5 million rand into the company in investments. Well, 5 million is nothing. And he was going to put a 50 in. He also said he's going to start a new paper in the Eastern Cape before the election, which I thought was singularly dumb language. I mean, if you're going to do it because of the election, you, as a newspaper owner, you don't say so. You say, well, this is our rollout, and you use some other term. You don't say it's for the election, which obviously means he wants to influence the election with a newspaper by April. I don't know that he can, because I've spoken to people in his office today as well, and I just don't see how it can be done. But he's doing all the wrong things. He's, you know, the bluster he came with right in the beginning seems to be one's fear that it was just bluster seems to be confirmed by everything. You know that he fired a leader, does know. There are other people he's fired. I was trying to get through to them this morning to see if I could mention their names, but I haven't been able to, so I can't. But you'll hear it soon enough. There are more firings coming of prominent people. There's a dispute. I can say this because this is not decided. Terry Bell, the Labour columnist, has been told not to write for the moment, but he wasn't due to write for the moment, so he's waiting to hear. If they drop him, that would be considered extremely shocking. Most importantly, because he's so damn good, he knows the Labour sector better than anyone. But secondly, because he was an ANC man, as it happens, the thing is, and he believes in unions. The trouble is, he believes in honest unions, and he fights hard for honest unions. He's very protective and supportive of trade unionism, but honest ones, and so if they do that, that would be very foolish, and that will lead to other journalists resigning in solidarity. So it looks really bad. I mean, this fratricidal conflict we're seeing in the papers every day, it's just shocking. And in fact, what shocked me more, I can't name the person I spoke to this morning, was that they were unaware of it. They didn't seem to be in touch enough, people close to Survey, to know that there's this fratricidal drama being played out here on their own newspapers in Cape Town, and that people are so shocked and feel the impending loss of the Cape Times, which is a real community publication. It really holds Cape Town together in ways that no other publication could do. You know, we all read its editors, the letters pages, because we all know the people who write to them, and some of them are really important people. George Ellis, professor of maths, writes on all sorts of issues, and all of that could be lost. But I deeply fear that no good is going to come out of this, and that people will resign, and then there'll be some kind of compromise. But you know, of course, if you want to be an important newspaper as opposed to one that just gets government ads to keep you going, your most important resource is your credibility, and the credibility is being shattered. I did want to just bring this up, as you know, the Washington Post, which I used to write for, has been in terrible financial decline, is now being sold to the head of Amazon, Jeff Bezos. and he's going to run it privately. Well, that's really just a portend of the fact that you can't afford to make mistakes in newspapers. Now, newspapers are going to close in South Africa, as they have all over the world anyway. And you have to be very nimble and smart just to keep them surviving. And they have a monopoly in Cape Town in English language newspapers. And, you know, they could just survive. I can't see how all of them can survive. I mean, the Argus, I can't understand why they have the Argus and the Cape Times both in the same morning market. I just cannot see any logic there to that. When I first saw that, which was a decision of the Irish, by the way, I thought that was some way of closing, leading to the closure without actually admitting responsibility for it. So I, you know, in this climate, with the internet getting so strong, young people not buying newspapers, so many sources of information, including even radio, the danger is very severe, and surveys' comments just seem to be more and more thoughtless. I just don't see where he's making decisions that will stand up, except that he'll get government advertising.
But where did he get his money from?
Well, he paid $2 billion, but it's not really $2 billion. Very little was his own. First of all, a proportion came from the Irish themselves. Now, that may surprise you, but the Irish had a great vested interest in doing this deal because it frees up money for them in Ireland with banks and so on. So by selling the company for $2 billion, they got a tranche of borrowings released. So they did, allowed some of it. The PIC, which is, you know, the government's pension investment company, has put up quite a substantial amount of the money. China has put up a substantial amount of the money. So it's China, PIC, Ireland, and finally Iqbal's survey and Sekhinjala himself. It's possible that he only put up $200 or $300 million. And of course, where did that come from? He has a successful fisheries business, and you've heard the stories about why it's successful. And obviously the Chinese notion of press freedom may just differ a tad from ours. The PIC, what I can't understand, you know, I've been following the PIC quite a lot lately in their investment plans, because it's one of the biggest investors in South Africa by far. But they have shares in Times Media as well. Now, newspaper companies are not somewhere where you go if you're really trying to build your business and build your investments for the long term. So to have a big interest in Times Media and in Independent by PIC raises questions for me. And I don't know if you followed what they did with Adcock. You know, they've just been involved in a controversy over an attempt to purchase a pharmaceutical company called Adcock. And PIC blocked that deal. And I followed that. Ann Crotty of the Business Report writes a lot about that, and I followed it closely, and it's not clear to me that their decisions, I may be wrong, it's not clear, but it's not absolutely clear that their decisions are purely being based on the investment interests of their pensioners.
When you say the Chinese, who do you exactly mean?
I can't answer that. It is a Chinese company with government links. I think it would be banking.
Please, do you know what's happening to Die Burger?
In what sense?
Well, I know that it's very well read with amongst the coloured people.
Yes.
And of course, I'm Afrikaans, so therefore I would read it.
Yes.
So, do you know what the stats are? Do you know how
Well, I can't tell you, but I they won't stop me making a few comments about it. Die Burger actually is in many respects been a good paper. They also criticise government, and often very well factually based criticisms, and get away with a lot because they're not in English. So often they're playing an oppositional role that is important, but they don't get the flack that the Cape Times would or the Mail and Guardian would for doing the same thing. I know that, you know, Koos Becker, who runs the company, doesn't really believe in newspapers as you know, because he's a television man and an internet man. But he's not going to close them, of course. He has protected them, but he has cut staff. There have been retrenchments even quite recently at the Die Burger. I assume it's still doing okay. The stats of all the newspapers are down. Yeah. I'm sure there's a down a bit, but I don't think it's terminal.
You know how I know that these coloured people read it and are intelligent about it? Listen to Cape Talk.
Yeah.
Their questions and yes. their answers are absolutely
yes. Yeah.
If this trend that you described with the Argus and the Cape Times, if the Cape Times were to have to close down, and it's linked to the trend of the secrecy policy, that sort of thing comes through, do you foresee the possibility of, I don't want to quite use an underground newspaper, but a kind of alternate newspaper springing up? And if so, who would finance that? You know, back in the old days, the Max Dupree's paper, was it called?
Fray
Vietra. That kind of thing.
And Weekly Mail, yeah.
Do you foresee that might happen?
You know, the trouble is, well, first of all, I don't initially see the Cape Times closing, because I think I think you and I are going to pay for it without subscriptions in taxpayers' funding, because it's going to be government advertising and so on. So I
want to read it, you know, if it's going to go there.
Yeah, it may not have readers. It'll just have advertising. But the problem, why this worries me so much, and even though I'm not working on that paper, and I don't see any obvious solutions, is this. The internet is changing the world of newspapers. I think that what will happen is the alternatives will be internet alternatives. I think Daily Maverick and Politics Web and Money Web and these things will grow. That's the more likely, because if you're going to invest in a newspaper, I thought if I were told to find a solution, I would come up with something I saw a lot, as it was very successfully in the States, in Chicago particularly, which is a free weekly that is given away free but has quality material in it.
Well, that's what I would.
That's or even a paid, but
who finances it?
Yeah, well, but the problem is, in this climate, it's not a place. It's the way to make a small fortune is to start with a large one.
Yeah. What about the New Age?
Well, the New Age is what about it? This one.
It seems to be carrying on publishing.
Yes, it has very low circulation, a lot of padded circulation figures. They're not members of the Audited Bureau of Circulation, so their figures are never audited officially. I think they're breaking even or even making a little profit because they're getting so much government support. It's government support.
The paper is available almost free of charge.
Absolutely. Yeah. You can have it even when you don't want it. Well, the Man and Guardian, they've come up with a completely new strategy. New editor, Chris Roper, I think his name is. His strategy is to move substantially towards an internet base and put up the price and have everything available on the net. So if you buy it, the price has gone up, but you can get it free online, and he wants to build it. He's got a whole lot of elaborate ideas about how to make it profitable as an internet operation. I just don't know if it's going to work, but that's his plan. He's really putting his faith in the internet.
Well,
they do get the jobs ads. The people, the companies, the newspapers that would suffer if government advertising is moved would be primarily the Mail and Guardian and the Sunday Times.
No, I'd agree. The Mail and Guardian has lost huge amounts of government advertising.
Yeah. Already?
For the last few years.
Yeah.
Since that thing came up.
Yeah. Yeah, well, then it's already.
You can download the Mail and Guardian on Kindle as well.
Yes. Yeah. That's their strategy. Whether it, everybody's had the problem. I mean, this is why the internet boom turned into an internet bubble and a bust, was because everybody saw the great value of it, but people couldn't find revenue streams that were reliable.
And I
Yeah. What has kept the New York Times going? I recently subscribed free to the New York Times, and that's a high quality newspaper.
Yes, but it's a short-term subscription. It's a trial subscription. You know, they're trying to hook you because they mishandled the launch of their internet system. New York Times, wasn't it sold for $1?
Yeah.
The newspaper. I mean, the whole company. The New York Times got into a lot of trouble, and they've rationalized various things, and they're now trying to make the internet strategy work. In fact, Steve Jobs, when they started, Steve Jobs said, offer your the New York Times on the internet at a very low figure. I can't remember exactly what it was, a couple of dollars. And they started off much higher, I think $29 or something, and people wouldn't pay it. And now they're trying to go the other route, but Steve Jobs, as so often, was right.
Given your remarks about the internet,
yes,
and the declining circulation, surely in 10 years' time, all the stuff about newspapers will be largely irrelevant. And all the stuff will be available online, and if somebody gets fired, they'll run a column online, and so their stuff will be available anyway to anybody who wants to read it. The Terry Bells and Cartier and whoever.
Documents will be available online.
That's true. But you know, I don't view, I mean, obviously we all see the value of the internet and social media and so on, but it's not, but it changes things in different ways. It's not the same. You know, just to take a step back, when radio arrived, a lot of reports said it's the end of newspapers. And of course that was wrong. It just changed the nature of newspapers. But then when television arrived, they said it was the end of radio. Of course, they were wrong too, but it did make big changes. What happened was people were listening to the radio at night. They stopped doing that, and increasingly it was just a drive time thing in the car in the morning, in the car in the afternoon. Now with this, there's going to be a major restructuring, and presumably there will be a place for newspapers or maybe more magazines or something. But let me just tell you some of the things that worry me. The Daily Telegraph in London, very conservative paper, but had a very good foreign service. That foreign service has collapsed to nothing. I don't think they have a single full-time foreign correspondent in the world. Now, that particular thing is not replaced by anybody. In other words, other newspapers are all facing the same thing. There isn't an internet source. I mean, if the New York Times pulls off their new plans, maybe they'll survive as that. But there's almost nobody else with an coming in with a foreign network that like the Telegraph had. The other thing is, of course, big investigations. The Washington Post probably couldn't do a Watergate today. I mean, I've been in debates in the States. In fact, exactly a year ago, I was on a platform with somebody who was arguing, doesn't matter, I still do investigations. This was on the West Coast in Silicon Valley. But it's not irrelevant. I don't think there would be a Watergate today. That's important. But there are pluses too, aren't there?
Yes. One tends to just think that it's going to be replaced by something totally different that maybe we don't know now. Somebody said, how are they going to be funded? Well, there'll be a way.
Yes, but it will be different. It'll gain, I mean, we gain a lot in that, you know, I get up in the morning and I read the Financial Times in London and the Washington Post in Washington, from my flat in Frontrook. Yes. You know, that is extraordinary. When I used to go to the States in the old days before internet, it would take me 3 or 4 weeks to feel I was in touch with my old friends then, that I could talk on the same level. I went back last year and I found I was in touch immediately. If I was really interested in a subject, I might know more about them than my friends did. So that's a massive change for the better. But it's, you know, there is the devil in the detail.
You've been focusing very much on the editorial side.
Yes.
What about advertising? If I go through on things like Facebook and the New York Times online, there's South African ads on there all the time.
Yeah.
Plenty of them, and lots more coming.
But there's, the viable business model that gives you journalism is still the question.
Well, for example, you can get Eyewitness News.
Yes.
As a feed through on Facebook.
Yes, yes, but Eyewitness News is good for instant news. It's shallow, it's very short term, and so on. If you want a big investigation, someone's got to pay for it. If you want, we should be having journalists all over Africa now. We're so engaged in so many countries now.
Is it not possible that moving away from necessarily newspapers being like, that's a good newspaper, and that's towards journalists? I mean, I get all my news on my phone because I follow all the journalists on Twitter.
Yes.
It's not necessarily, like, I follow all the newspapers and stuff like that, so I'll get the headlines for the stories they're pushing, but more often they'll be like, Gareth Johnson wrote a new piece, let me go read that, rather than necessarily, and then similarly following UK and US journalists, rather than necessarily following their papers.
Yes. Yes, I think a lot of those things are happening, and we don't really know how, it's never going to end, it's going to keep changing. But, in South Africa, what will replace Cape Times as the community glue in Cape Town? I don't know the answer to that. Maybe it will be a website. Maybe it'll be Map My Way.
Can I change the subject?
Sure.
How would you like to talk to us about Nosweek, yes. SABC, yes, a whole stash of money in Switzerland, and an interdict?
Oh, that case, yes, sure.
Just before we go on to that, these little curated newspapers like Mel Gibbs puts out from Durban. Is it Mel Gibbs?
No. I know what you mean.
I get it on email, and he's got CNN, the New York Times, the Telegraph, and half a dozen newspaper stories from them on a daily email basis. And he's getting advertising and that sort of thing as well. Now, it's obviously being put out and syndicated somewhere in the States, because it doesn't have an American slot to. You've got BBC on it.
Yeah, I mean, look, one of the ways I get my news, where there are cases like the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times that charge you, there's a way around. The number of ways around it. One of them is to go to these sites that pull them together. And one of them that I use is Real Clear Politics and Real Clear World in the States. If you go to Real Clear Politics, you'll get the latest columns from the New York Times, and it has a conservative bias, but they do have liberal and left things as well.
The New York Times itself is on Facebook.
Yeah. Yeah, so there was one. Let me just take up the Absa story. It's really quite fascinating. What happened was, when the Reserve Bank, the South African Reserve Bank, decided to investigate money that had gone missing in the apartheid era, and what it was the Absa bailout. And the Absa bailout, what was the figure they had? It was quite a small figure, a few billion, had been done without the public being told. It appeared on Absa's books as a loan, but it was never publicly disclosed what it was. So they started the investigation. What happened was they used a former MI6 guy in London who did a lot of work, and he came up with a much bigger and bigger project. And he said he's finding hundreds of millions, billions. And they gave him an extra year to carry on and paid him. And at the end of that year, he said, I need one more year and I'll be finished. And they said, no, we're pulling the plug. We won't have it anymore. He then said, decided to carry it on. He said, I'll do it for you on contingency. I'm so sure of myself, I'll do this work for you for nothing. And when it comes through, I'll take X percent of what you get back. And they said, fine. Then when he came and said, I'm ready to publish, they said, no, we don't want to have anything to do with you anymore. So why? Well, this is a story that Nosweek got, and then Sylvia Vollenhoven made a movie of for SABC. Now, Sylvia knows the ropes to the SABC. She went through every stage. She showed them her plan. They paid her an initial fee. She then took it to a certain stage, got another fee. She then made the movie, got another fee, finalized, edited version, handed it to them, and got paid in full. Suddenly, they said they're not publishing, and they're not broadcasting it. She said, why? And eventually she got an email from the SABC that said, actually said something like the government feels it would be too damaging. So then the question is, this is all about the old government, so why did the new government find it too damaging to publish anything of the old government? And the answer is, because the current government people who are using arms dealers and various other shady characters were using the same ones that the old regime used. And that's why they can't publish it, because the people who would be affected have said, that's fine, you touch us, we're bringing you all down. And that's why that thing was never ever run. And she's now trying to remake it on her own, and they've suspended all her other work. She had several hundred thousand rands worth of work with the SABC, which they've refused. So she's going to run out of money one of these days. And she can't. And they've also sent her legal letters indicating that she can't make a new version of the old film, because the point is, she said, I'll make it entirely from scratch, you can't control my head, I know who to go to, I can do every interview afresh. And they said, if we do, you'll be interdicted. So that's where it is.
Already interdicted.
Yes, so that's where it is right.
I'd like to ask you a question. We know that Barring Duplessis was on the one side. Who's on the ANC side directing affairs?
I don't know. But the arms deal was a big part of it. Because I covered the arms deal from Parliament in the early 2000s, 99, 2000s. What I can't understand is, you know, if you want to buy, well, it's perfectly obvious. If you want to buy planes from British Aerospace and you're in the Union buildings, surely you phone up British Aerospace. Why do you need a middleman? Well, yeah, the answer seems to be, all the indications about the arms deal are that the reason it worked out the way it did was because they wanted to fund the ANC with the kickbacks. Now, once you try to fund the ANC with the kickbacks, you have to have people you give the money to. And so they gave the money to other people in the ANC, and they thought a small cut in this would be nice, and a bigger cut would be nicer. Anything else? We're sort of over time. We're done? No, thanks very much.